Hey there, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. We're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Alexis.
And I'm Chris Scully. Today, part three of Corin's interview with Republican Troy mayoral candidate Tom Riehl.
And then Aaron Pettinati speaks to longtime activist Joe Seaman about his potential run for state assembly.
And later on, we'll hear this week's episode of Women in STEM.
After that, Caleb Winters, chair of the Upper Hudson Green Party, talks with Elizabeth Press about opportunity to ballot.
Finally, Mark Dunley speaks to 350.org organizer Dominique Thomas about New York State Attorney General's lawsuit against ExxonMobil. But first, here are some headlines.
Mary Sullivan was sworn in Friday as the new president of the Civil Services Employee Association, replacing Danny Donahue, who had a 25-year tenure. Sullivan will serve out the remaining few months of Donahue's term. Sullivan, the first CSEA head to emerge from local government, had served as executive vice president throughout Donahue's tenure.
This Tuesday is Election Day, with polls open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. On the ballot will primarily be candidates for local office, including for Troy and Schenectady mayor and city council. Rensselaer County lagged behind Albany and Schenectady in terms of the number of voters who took advantage of this year's early voting.
The Troy Record reports that the City of Troy is conducting a series of public focus groups to obtain input into the city's 2020-2024 consolidated plan for the Federal Community Development Block Grant Program. Focus groups will be held from 6 to 8 p.m., with the next ones taking place November 12th at Troy City Hall and November 14th at the Arnold E. Fallon Community Center.
Erecting wind turbines on the world's best offshore sites could provide more than enough clean energy to meet global electricity demand, according to a report from the International Energy Agency. The coastal area off of Long Island is considered the world's best site for offshore wind turbines.
In many upstate communities, colleges are among the largest sources of waste and energy use. State legislators are pushing for public and private colleges across the state to develop strategies for shrinking their large environmental footprints. This includes getting colleges to expand composting efforts and to reduce single-use plastics in dining halls.
The Times Union on Sunday published audio obtained from a closed-door meeting last month when Republican County Executive Steve McLaughlin and other state employees within the GOP tried to pressure Troy mayoral candidate Tom Riehl, the Republican Party's endorsed candidate, to drop out of the race and endorse Rodney Wilshire. Wilshire, who has previously served as a city council president, ran for mayor this year initially as a Democrat, but after losing the party nomination, is now running as an independent. McLaughlin is heard verbally accosting and making unspecified threats to Riehl, who has since publicly announced both dropping out of the race and re-entering it. The obtained audio is too explicit for radio, but it can be found on the Times Union website. The election is this Tuesday, the 5th of November.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Okay, up first is the third and final part of Hudson Mohawk Magazine's three-part interview with Republican mayoral candidate Tom Riehl. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey talks to Riehl about criminal justice, community division, and where voters can find Riehl out and about in the Collar City.
Let's turn our attention to criminal justice for a moment.
Certainly.
One of the issues that I think divides our communities more than any other is how we deal with these twin problems of crime in areas like Lansingburg, as you mentioned, and aggressive policing and its effect on communities of color. How do you plan to address our diverse communities in Troy on those two issues?
We talk an awful lot about being one Troy, and that's a laudable goal. I think we should all be trying to be one Troy. We all live in the same city. We all largely have some of the same experiences based on that. When it rains, we all get rained on. When it snows, we all get snowed on. So in that sense, there should be more of a level of community. And it's sad to me when I see things happen that make it look like there's two very different Troys. That's something I think you can see in the difference between the burgeoning, growing downtown, the gentrifying downtown areas, South Central and whatnot, and then neighborhoods in North Central and Lansingburg can be very different culturally even. So it makes it difficult to have that kind of unity that you want to see. And I think the primary place to start, and I'm glad that the mayor decided to heed my call to restart the Police Objective Review Committee, because that's one area where we can get input from across the city.
Can you explain what that is for our listeners?
It's a review board that's put down to be able to have access to internal documents, internal affairs reports, that the committee can review what is in those reports and then make recommendations to the city, make recommendations to the police department on ways that can be improved. And if we can get a good cross-section of the city on this board, I think that's exactly what we need in order to affect the kind of changes that you're talking about when it comes to how aggressive is too aggressive on policing, what can police do to better integrate with communities of color, to have more support from communities of color. That's exactly what we need in order to try and get ourselves down that road towards one Troy. We might not be able to do it on every single issue. There are differences between somebody who lives in North Central and someone who lives in the new loft apartments downtown. There's just going to be some differences. But if we can reach a point where our policing, which is one of the things that we all share in common together as one police force, if we can find ways to make sure that the police are treating everyone fairly, are treating communities fairly, are treating everyone fairly in a way that everyone can be agreeable with, that's a good step in the right direction. And restarting this board, which is mandated by the city code, is a good step in that direction. And I absolutely applaud the mayor for doing that.
Speaking of internal affairs reports, a 37-year-old man named Edson Thevenin lost his life in April of 2016. There's been quite a bit of reporting, both on this station and in print media, about the two memos that were written. One was an internal affairs report that concluded that the officer was not justified in using deadly physical force when he fatally shot Thevenin, and that he obstructed justice in his answers to the investigation. The second memo was commissioned by the police chief and the mayor and has not been released to the public. The first one now has. Mm-hmm. What's your response to this controversy?
Well, I should add, the first one wasn't released until it was kind of forced out in the matter of the lawsuit against the city.
So, and it appears that it couldn't have been. That memo was not allowed to be released
right,
by law
right.
until a court authorized.
Right.
Yeah.
The second memo was produced by taxpayer dollars. It was produced by the city in order to refute its own report, essentially. So I think it's important that people have access to all of the facts of this situation, because there was a very strong sense of a cover-up from the very beginning when the district attorney's office rushed through the grand jury process in order to what it appears. I mean, I can't speak to the DA's rationale for doing so, but it gives the appearance that it was done in order to quickly absolve the police. People should have access to as much information as they can. This is the information age, after all. Without a full accounting of information, what happens is you end up with innuendos and discussions on exactly what really happened. And those things tend to, in this day and age, become established fact. And that's true on both sides, whether you're a full supporter of the police in this situation or you're a full supporter of the family. We need to have as much information out there as possible, especially considering that this report was commissioned using taxpayer dollars. For years, it has been a dividing factor, tearing our city apart. We need to find a way to get to a resolution that may not make everyone happy, but at least, you know, people will be able to make a better decision on exactly how they're supposed to feel about the situation.
To that point, what would be better, allowing this process to take place with due process through the court system and waiting for all of the information to come out, as the mayor says, or allowing a very complicated issue to be tried in the court of public opinion?
It already is going to be tried in the court of public opinion. what we're talking about here isn't so much the city's culpability or any of that element. I mean, I'm sure that part of the reason why it's being withheld is to try to help the city not have to pay out as much or anything in this matter. But when it comes to issues of this gravity, I think it's very crucial that for the sake of just harmony in our city, we should know exactly what experts are saying about what happened in this case so that both sides of the argument can make more rational decisions about what happened instead of the accusations that have flown from both sides.
Mayor Madden vetoed a city council resolution that would have established the Families and Communities Together Act, which many believe is shorthand for establishing a sanctuary city. Do you agree with the mayor's decision to veto that resolution?
Absolutely. I was opposed to sanctuary city status from the very beginning. And as a matter of fact, I would have gone a step farther than the mayor did, which was he kind of allowed the debate to continue for several months after it started by not being firm on his opposition. He stated through a spokesman in December that he was opposed to sanctuary city status at this time, which kind of allowed the debate to continue. And we just finished talking about divisiveness in our city. And this was something that really got nasty for too long of a time. If there had been a clear statement from the mayor himself at the end of last year that just said, we can't do sanctuary cities, it just doesn't make any sense for us at this time. We have a federal, you know, he could even say something like the federal government is opposed to sanctuary status. It would make it difficult for us to get grants. It would make us difficult to compete for money. We need money. And to be firm to say that this resolution would change very little to nothing about the way that our police interact with our immigrant communities. They're already not knocking on doors. They're already not, you know, looking for immigration status of anyone other than the people that are under arrest. So I understand where the supporters were coming from on it, but it was put forward in a way that helped to continue to divide an already divided community. And it was allowed to fester because we didn't have a leader in place that was willing to take an absolute stand. It allowed both sides to kind of start jostling for position for months afterwards. And it really took all of the air out of any other discussions for months on end, well into the summer, well, even past the primary process for this election. So it's something that I don't think, if you're opposed to sanctuary city status, that you're necessarily anti-immigrant. I don't think that you're soft on crime if you're a supporter of sanctuary cities. But these were the things that crystallized.
Other than at home, where can Trojans find you around town being yourself? In other words, what's one Troy spot that you can hang out in and be yourself?
Well, I'm an RPI graduate, so it's if there's one spot, just me, it would certainly be at The Rock downtown. I mean, it's where you, once you turn 21 at RPI, it's kind of the space to hit. At least it was in the earlier parts of last decade when I was a student there. It's an even nicer place now that it's kind of a craft bar that you can get a menu at. So it's a nice place to hang out and be myself for sure.
I'm going to give you another shot though and ask you where Tom Reel, the father of two young daughters, can be found being himself.
Woof. Well, that's closer. You know, that's probably the YMCA then. <'Cause> every now and then I just got to hit that sauna and just get some of that stress out of me. Because even before the campaign, I mean, just having to juggle my oldest Mackenzie is going to be 3 next month and my youngest Fiametta is going to be 1. But as the dad, Tom Reel would probably be more likely to be seen at the YMCA, which is just around the corner from where I live. And it's an opportunity for me to just get a little workout in, get that sauna on, get that stress sweated out of my body. So yeah, right. That's how we all grow, right? From the bar to the gym.
Well, thanks so much for coming into the studio and talking. As Trojans are going to the polls and voting for the first time in early voting, your name has always been on the ballot through this process, and your campaign has been restarted. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I very much enjoyed this.
Reel is challenging incumbent mayor Patrick Madden, Socialist Workers' Party Ved Dukan, and independent candidate Rodney Wilshire as Trojans head to the polls for early voting this year. Election day is this Tuesday, November 5th.
All right, and moving right along. At the We the People event in Glens Falls this past September, longtime Capital Region activist Joe Seaman was harassed by far-right activist Mike Kibling, WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati was at the event and spoke with Seaman about this experience and about his potential run for public office.
This is Aaron Pettinati. Last week, I started my segment with an introduction explaining the context of the interview that was featured in it. Since this is part two of that interview and the context is equally relevant, I'm going to play that introduction again right now. On the afternoon of Saturday, September 21st, I attended the We the People event in Glens Falls City Park. Throughout the event, there was a microphone set up in the park at which speakers addressed a group of peaceful demonstrators who were gathered to express their concerns over the threat posed by the Trump administration to American democracy. At one point during the proceedings, a small group of Trump supporters approached, carrying large flags bearing the president's name. The demonstrators stood near them with their own signs, neither touching nor speaking to the Trump supporters. As a speaker was addressing the crowd through the microphone, one of these Trumpers began shouting at the demonstrators through a megaphone that he had brought to the event, despite the fact that he was standing only a few feet away from them. This was Mike Kibling, a far-right activist and member of a group called the North Country Deplorables, who frequently harasses left-leaning protesters in the Glens Falls area and was recently photographed pointing a toy gun at a Post-Star journalist. Kibling began his rant by exclaiming, "You don't get to touch me, Joe," several times through his microphone. To this, the crowd of demonstrators responded by breaking into Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land," to which Kibling responded by mocking the demonstrators for doing, quote, "the same effing thing every time," end quote, alluding to the fact that they had sung the same song at a previous demonstration. He then mockingly complimented them for their originality in standing in a circle and began to run around the perimeter of that circle, shouting "duck, duck, goose," and then skipping around the inside of the circle wearing a deranged, hostile smirk that combined the demeanor of an enraged fascist provocateur with that of a gleefully misbehaving five-year-old. The Joe to whom Kibling was referring was Joe Seaman, a longtime Capital Region activist who is currently considering a run for public office. At several points throughout his rant, Kibling screamed obscenities at Seaman with a hostility that seemed loaded with the threat of physical violence. As the event was ending, I talked with Joe Seaman and got his reaction to Kibling's behavior.
So you're about to hear the second part of that interview in which Joe reflects on his experience of harassment and then talks about his plan to potentially run for the state senate in Saratoga County.
One last thing I want to ask you about is whether you have concerns for your personal safety given the level of animosity that's been directed at you by some of the members of this group.
Sure. Well, you know, I've lived a good 59 years on this earth, and I'm not that terribly concerned. I think we all must stand for what we must stand. I guess I'll say this on the radio, though it's not widely publicly known. I'm considering running for a public office, and that's why they're particularly throwing their hate against me. And I'm sure that if there were other people planning on running, considering running for a public office, they would be the subject or the victim of their attacks. So they attack Hillary Clinton, lock her up, remember that. Say, send her back. They talk about women of color in our Congress, Americans who they want to send back somewhere. So their hatred is about dividing us, and it's also particularly about trying to throw the nastiest, vicious dirt. They'll make up all kinds of dirt, just like they did against Hillary Clinton, just like they did against John Kerry, if anybody remember when Kerry was Swift-boated. So this is what they do. This is what they've always done. FDR, I think he said it best, "I welcome their hate." So I'm not going to let it intimidate me. I don't think anybody, especially anybody who's considering running for public office, and if you live in Saratoga County, in the towns of, and I'll go through this here, Clifton Park, Half Moon, Ballston, Charlton, Galway, Providence, Greenfield, or Milton, as I do, or in the Schenectady town of Glenville, you're part of the 112th New York Assembly District. So if you live there, I want you to look up my website. It's a terrible, awful, piss-poor website we just created. It's unpolitician.us. So that's why they're throwing their hatred, particularly at me. And don't worry, I don't take it personally. You know, people have withstood a lot worse. There are people today who are really suffering. There are people seeking refuge. What America is all about, people come to America to escape gang violence, to escape terrible, horrific conditions, and they're coming to our borders. They have a legal right to come here and seek asylum. And those are the people who are really suffering from the hatred of Trump and Stefanik and their party of hate. So there are people who really, we really have to worry about. There are lots of people we really have to be concerned. Their lives are in danger. 7 children have died in these awful detention camps. And that's who I'm worried about. And people of America who are dying because they don't have enough health insurance. I know of a young man here in Saratoga County who ran out of his medication for treating his depression because he missed a $25 insurance payment. And tragically, this young man killed himself. And those are the people who are suffering from lack of health care, people who are suffering from the abuse of refugees, the people in the Bahamas who suffered from these dramatic storms, powerful, terrible storms that are created by climate change, people suffering in lots of other places due to the policies of Stefanik, Trump, and the billionaire class that they represent. Those are the people who I'm concerned about.
And do you want to disclose what office you're running for, or does that have to wait for a future interview?
Sure. Well, it's right on my website, unpolitician.us, and I'm considering, it's not a definite thing, I'll be frank with you, I'm considering running for the New York 112th Assembly District. This past session, we had a Democratic Senate and a Democratic Assembly, and we passed a lot of powerful legislation, but there's a lot more we need to. I was in there along with people calling for universal health care, calling for voting reform. I was there in the assembly, in the Capitol, in the legislative office building in Albany a lot this year. And, you know, you don't have to be a professional politician to run for office. At least I hope not. So I'm not a politician. I don't look like a politician. You can't tell that over the radio. I don't act like one. I don't have millionaire or billionaire friends like many politicians do. So I'm hoping that an average person who represents the interests of average New Yorkers, average people, who doesn't take money from billionaires, who's not in with any big money special corporate interest, I'm hoping that that is something that will resolve with voters. We'll see. It's a district that has a very heavy Republican advantage. I realize that. I realize the Republicans, the incumbent, will have a lot of money. The incumbent ran unopposed in the New York 112th district. That same incumbent has not had a single town hall ever. She's been in office, this is her second term. She's been in office 3+ years. Not a single town hall ever anywhere. And that's not democracy. So if I'm going to run for this, and I'm not quite sure, I'm still waiting to see her if there's anybody better than me. So I'm considering running, and if I do, I'm happy if I win. And if I don't win, but we have a little bit of democracy happening here in Saratoga County and Schenectady County as part of democracy we're trying to create all across America, that's great. And if I do run, I'm going to tell anybody who's interested in my campaign, 1, if you're physically capable of getting your butt out to Pennsylvania, out to Maine or New Hampshire, to any swing state, Ohio, if you can get to a swing state in 2020 and help us defeat Trump, whether it's Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, I happen to have a preference of those, but Kamala Harris, whoever we have, get yourself out there and help beat Trump. And if it's beyond your capabilities, which I understand many people it is, if it's beyond your capabilities of getting out there to a swing state, please get involved in local elections. Let's try and make the New York State Legislature a little more progressive. We can pass Health Care for All, the New York Health Act, right here in New York. We passed a great climate community bill recently, and that's just the beginning of what we need to do to bring a real Green New Deal here in New York. We can take the money that you're spending on your national grid bill, that you're spending when you fill up at the mobile station, we can take that money that's going into pockets of billionaires and keep that money in our pockets, in our communities, if we're producing our own energy, if we're saving the energy that we don't consume by conservation, we're putting money into our pockets, we're creating jobs in our communities, and that's one of the things that we must do here in New York. So if I'm chosen by the voters, if I do run, if I'm chosen by the voters, that's what I intend to do.
And in one word, can you name the candidate out of the three presidential candidates that you support?
Warren. Elizabeth Warren. Excuse me. Sorry, I had a little cough there. But really, I was a supporter of Bernie in the 2016 primaries, and then I was a supporter of Hillary. And I really would be happy any of the candidates, even the many candidates who were hardly known of how many are left, 10 or 12, any of them are people who have a shred of decency and of dignity. And I may not agree with all of the things Joe Biden has to say, but any of them, I'd be proud to support.
Well, thanks very much for this interview, Joe.
Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for being here. And thanks to the Sanctuary for Independent Media and all the people who are bringing these voices to the airs.
And that was WOOC correspondent Aaron Pedinati speaking with activist Joe Seaman for part two of that interview at We the People event in Glens Falls.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Chris Scully. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. And if you have comments, suggestions, or you want to volunteer, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget that 7 to 10 weeknights, we have Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Nature Lab intern Sophia Cahillane interviews Dr. Jamie Kotler about her research and studies in computer science and being a woman in STEM.
This is Sophia Cahillane with Dr. Jamie Kotler from Siena College, where she researches and teaches computer science. So it's great that you were able to come down here tonight.
Thank you so much for asking me.
Of course. So I wanted to start it off with just a couple questions about how you originally got interested in STEM and computer science specifically.
Okay. I would say absolutely it was my father. When I was in high school, he got a computer. He loved technology. He was an architect. Was his first profession, but he really loved technology. So he encouraged me. He brought home this, it was sort of like a Macintosh, but it had cassette tapes, and it was a really interesting, but it was my first all-night project was with him. And he kept encouraging me throughout college and then beyond to get into STEM or in computer science specifically. Mm-hmm. But I did, my undergraduate degree was in economics. With his encouragement, I kept taking computer science courses. I was a Calc 3 course away from having a dual major. But I thought economics, that's where I was going to be, but life had a different idea. And all of my jobs, I ended up doing something in computer science, so I just decided, okay, this is where I'm meant to be.
Yeah, I guess that's what
yes.
Life is telling me.
Exactly.
So can you give me an overview of kind of what you're researching right now, what you're really focusing on?
Sure. Well, I could really break it into two different projects. So one is using emotional reactions and technology to detect empathy. So when you could see if it's an empathetic response or not. So that's one project. And then the other project, I'm looking at employability and promotability in the tech sector. So what are those things that can really help people? And with a particular focus on emotional intelligence, so the soft skills, as well as mindfulness. So we're kind of looking at everything.
I did a little background research, checked out your bio or whatever, and I noticed a lot of emphasis on the emotional and social intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, well, okay, first of all, I was impressed because I knew all these people going into the technological fields and kind of they get the background of everything that's happening in the real world. And I think it's really important that they know what's happening with what they're doing online or all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's awesome. Good
Thank
for you.
You. Thank you.
And so I was wondering if this helped a lot with women in computer science. Have you noticed like that? I don't know if you might have noticed this at all, but just your teaching mm-hmm. style or how you go about promoting this emotional and social intelligence, if that helps a lot of women?
I would say yes. I mean, we, because of the work that my colleagues do at Siena, we have, you know, not the typical ratio. So we do have more women in teaching in the department as well as students. But I would say absolutely with the social emotional intelligence, I think when you have that focus, it just helps with the team dynamics, especially if there's only one woman on a team. It brings about an awareness that I think otherwise might be missed. And yeah. In particular, I think it's giving women a voice. So when we are the only one in the room, to really feel like we can have that voice and you know, and just have that confidence to do that.
I kind of going off of that, have you ever experienced unconscious biases or implicit biases from your peers or in day-to-day life at all?
Yes. Yeah,
can you explain it a bit?
I would say, you know, just questioning abilities. I think it is different. That one I would have to think about a little bit more. But I have absolutely experienced that, and I think if you know all things are equal, I have almost felt like I've had to work a little harder to have the same.
Definitely is a problem at that point. I know that computer science has typically been a male field, at least more recently after the original computers were invented. But I understand it might be harder in an atmosphere such as that instead of a different field that may have more women generally in the professional sector. So can understand that. But
yes.
So you mentioned having to work harder and with this kind of judgment from peers. Have you experienced what is known as imposter syndrome?
Yes, of course. And I teach our senior capstone course. So it's a year-long course. So I coach and mentor students on this, particularly because they're going to be going out into the world. But absolutely, so much, because my work isn't the traditional research. So absolutely. You know, sort of feeling, am I supposed to be here? Do I have enough? Mm-hmm. Do I, you know, I started collecting degrees because I didn't think I had enough.
Oh, geez.
So, so I had one master's and I went to RPI, got another one, and then I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, the PhD. So so I sort of noticed that, and I thought, you know what, I just need to be authentic. And when you show up authentic, then I think then you feel less like an imposter because you're who you are and you could just be the best version of that.
Have you been able to kind of impart that message to any young woman that you teach?
I try to every day. I infuse in this course, they work on real projects. So everything that they learn, it's really experientially learned.
Cool.
So they learn the topics, then they actually get to do them, work with teams.
Yeah.
And through that, I absolutely share my own experiences, but also really try to empower them. Again, to be authentic, so not to go out and try to be what the person is next to them, but to be who they are, and I think to really have that voice and show up in that way is pretty powerful.
Yeah. So, I was wondering what message you might want to share with young girls who could be interested in STEM or who are considering it, something to encourage them to pursue a career in science?
To follow your passion. And it's such a dynamic field now that if you like technology, there's so many different things that you can do. So, you know, there's some stereotypes out there, and you can certainly do that, but there's so much more. So if you're interested in user interface design or security, or, you know, there's just so many other things, project management or the tech. If you want to design actual hardware, there's so many things. So to really explore it, because it's a field that's really cool to be in.
Thank you very much for coming down today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
And again, that was Sophia K. Helene interviewing Dr. Jamie Kotler about her research and studies in computer science. If you want to learn more about the Women in STEM series, check out Sophia's People Power page on the Sanctuary's website, mediasanctuary.org.
Next up, Caleb Winters, the chair of Upper Hudson Green Party, speaks with Elizabeth Press about the elections in Troy, opportunity to ballot, and the role of third parties.
Caleb Winters is the chair of the Upper Hudson Green Party. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Caleb.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just start off with recent news. So I read a press release where the Green Party came out in support of Tom Riehl staying in the race. Can you explain that for our audience?
Of course. It was not an endorsement of Tom Riehl. It was standing with Tom Riehl against the corruption and the bullying by Steve McLaughlin, Jim Gordon, John Sweeney, and other party bosses in the Republican Party.
Now, I just saw in the Times Union this weekend that there were some tapes released of that bullying itself. Can you explain for those that don't know what happened with Tom Riehl putting his campaign on suspension and then coming back in?
Yeah, initially, as I understand it, Tom Riehl only wanted to run for city council, and he was pushed by the Republicans to run for mayor, even though he didn't feel comfortable doing that. And they have given him zero support the entire time. He's a young, up-and-coming person in their party, and they have threatened him with his livelihood and his family, and they forced him out of the race and wanted him to endorse Rodney Wiltshire before the first mayoral debate.
And why do you think it's important for the Green Party to come out in support of Riehl staying in the race?
It wasn't really us supporting him staying in the race, but it was just him standing up to bullies and political corruption, which the Green Party does daily.
So actually, just staying on that, can you just explain a little bit of the values of the Green Party and what you stand for?
Sure. We're a party of peace. We believe in justice for oppressed communities. I guess locally, how it impacts us, we were in support of Troy becoming a sanctuary city. Yeah.
And so that just brings me to this election, and elections are on Tuesday. On the Green Party ballot line, there are several Republicans or Carmelo Montella, Jim Gulley, Seamus Donnelly. I think even Rodney Wiltshire's on your party ballot line. Do these folks line up with your values? Do you support them on your ballot line? And just explain how they ended up there.
We do not support any of those candidates on our ballot lines. We only have two candidates on the ballot this year, one in the town of Colony and one in the town of Niskayuna. So none in Troy or Rensselaer County. Rodney Wiltshire actually approached us about helping him gather green signatures to get him on the ballot. And we told him, which he already knew, but we reiterated to him that we do not support Democrats, Republicans, or their allied parties on our ballot line or otherwise. And he went ahead and filed those petitions anyway, right after we had that conversation. And Carmelo Montella did the same thing with the assistance of Seamus Donnelly, family members, who is running against Anasha Cummings in District 4. And I have the opportunity to ballot petitions right here where Sean Donnelly, Seamus Donnelly's brother, signed it. Sarah McDermott, his cousin, helped. And Paul Laviano, Carmelo Mantello's son, signed the opportunity to ballot petition. They're all Republican family members enrolled in the Green Party and signing petitions only for Republican candidates and Rodney Wiltshire.
The importance of this is not only that Republicans are on the Green Party line and maybe don't actually line up. I know I don't think any of those people supported Troy Sanctuary City, for instance.
No, all the mayoral candidates are against Sanctuary City.
The Green Party did try in the primary to run people for mayor, for city council president, and at least in District 1. So what happened to those people? Why aren't they on the ballot? Can you just explain how this works?
Yeah, we quickly got together a slate of candidates, write-in candidates, after we realized that our line was being stolen again by Carmella Wiltshire and Jim Gulley. And they did win on election night, but unfortunately, the Republicans have a strong absentee ballot game. Many of them were carried by Sarah McDermott, Seamus Donnelly's cousin, and they were given out to Republican family members registered in the Green Party, and they supported Wiltshire for mayor and Jim Gulley for District 1 and Carmel Mantello for city council president on the Green Line.
So I recently interviewed Jim Gulley, and I asked him about him appearing on the Green Party line. And he said that he went around and talked to Green Party members and got their support. Can you explain what might be happening? Because it feels like a difference between what you're saying. And
sure. District 1, District 2, and District 6 in the city of Troy are the worst offenders for Republicans being registered in the Green Party. And that's who Jim Gulley's referring to, is who's supporting him, his Republican friends who have enrolled in the Green Party, much through the help of Rich Crist and other party bosses.
What is the role of keeping alive an Upper Hudson Green Party, the role of having a third party if it's going to be co-opted by people who don't align with your values?
It's very tough. We are lobbying the new Campaign Finance Commission to eliminate opportunity to ballot and fusion voting, which is the methods in which our party is co-opted. We do try to run candidates. We ran a candidate in my district, District 3 in Troy, 2 years ago, Neil Wahab, unsuccessfully, unfortunately. But we ran a clean campaign, and credit to the other candidates for running a clean campaign as well. And actually, in this year in District 3, Jamie Mager, the Republican who's running, and Sue Steele, the Democrat who's running, I brokered a deal with them not to steal our ballot line this year, which I was very proud to have them both be honest and run clean campaigns.
What does that look like to broker a deal?
It was just getting them to agree not to steal our line because it's immoral, we feel, and luckily they agreed with that. And the Democrats have stolen our line in the past. This year it was the Republicans, but 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago, it was a lot of Democrats stealing our line in the same methods. We've actually had Cindy Doran enroll as a Green Party member. Previously, she enrolled as a Conservative member just to get those ballot lines.
I think even Eileen McDermott is on the Green Party line, this time as a Democrat as well.
Yes, she is. And we were unaware of that until very recently. The Board of Elections is not very good about providing the Green Party, especially with information about who's petitioned for our line.
And you've mentioned the term opportunity to ballot. Can you just take a moment to explain what opportunity to ballot is and how it plays out in New York State, and also the fact that many other states no longer have opportunity to ballot?
Sure. There's 7 states in the U.S. that still have opportunity to ballot, and one of those states only uses it in presidential elections. It's a method where people that are not registered in a party can circulate a petition amongst party members, get their signatures, and then get on the ballot line through a primary, through a write-in slot. So in order for the Green Party to stop opportunity to ballot from happening, we would have to run 2 candidates for every single race that exists in New York State every single year.
Can you go into that a little bit more? I don't quite understand.
If one candidate is an actual green and someone follows an opportunity to ballot, the real green gets their line on the ballot. The second person gets a write-in slot. If there's no Green Party members, there's only a write-in slot. So if there were 2 Green Party members for each office, there would be 2 real green names there and no write-in slot. And that's the only way to stop opportunity to ballot.
And what about on the bigger scale? You said there's only 7 states left that have opportunity to ballot. Will New York ever consider not having it?
It seems likely that maybe fusion will be banned through this campaign finance committee. So we're hopeful for that. But unfortunately, one thing that they've recently tried to do is raise the number of gubernatorial votes needed to maintain your ballot status. Currently, it's 50,000, and the Green Party has maintained it for three cycles, so 12 years now. And before that, we had a four-year period back in the 90s. And they're thinking of raising it to 250,000, which would only allow the Conservative Party, Democratic Party, and Republican Party to maintain ballot status based on this last governor's race.
Oh, wow. So even the working families would be off the ballot as well.
Correct.
As the chair of the Upper Hudson Green Party going into elections on Tuesday, what do you want our audience to go into elections knowing?
I want them to be aware of the corruption and the bullying that goes on in both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. I would also ask that no one vote for any candidate on the Green Party line other than our candidate in the town of Niskayuna and our candidate in the town of Colony.
Great. Is there anything else you want to add, Caleb?
We meet the last Tuesday of every month at the Honest Weight Food Co-op in Albany on Watervliet Ave. And we've got some exciting events planned coming up where we're going to have the former leader of the Wales Green Party come and talk to us about the green wave sweeping European politics.
Great. And just to add, the Green Party is quite big in other places in the world.
Yes, mainly where opportunity to ballot and fusion does not exist. California, we are very large right now and growing.
Again, that was correspondent Elizabeth Press speaking with Upper Hudson Green Party Chair Caleb Winters.
The trial has started in the lawsuit by the New York State Attorney General against ExxonMobil about defrauding investors on the realities of climate change. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley talks with Dominique Thomas, a regional organizer for 350.org.
We're speaking with Dominique Thomas, who's an organizer for 350.org. In fact, the New York and Mid-Atlantic regional organizer. 350, of course, is one of the major, climate activist groups in actually in the world. And Dominique, I know the 350 has been very supportive of this lawsuit that the New York State Attorney General has taken against Exxon for misleading investors about the reality of climate change. Why does 350 think this is an important lawsuit?
Yeah, it's really important because, as you know, Exxon is one of the largest fossil fuel companies in the world. And so for New York, this is really a big stepping stone, setting a precedent of really holding fossil fuel companies accountable for their actions when it comes to climate destruction. So particularly for this lawsuit, this is a security fraud lawsuit where they're holding Exxon accountable for defrauding their investors. Basically, they lied to their investors about the effects of climate change and have known about the effects of climate change for decades and have utilized their power and privilege to block any meaningful action about countering those effects. And so it's really important to be on a platform and to be in public to show how not only have they defrauded their investors, but also the public about the effects of climate change and just their general practices. And for us at 350, this is really important in tying in and weaving in kind of making them pay and making fossil fuel companies pay for the destruction that they've caused. And whether that looks like climate reparations or paying for the effects of climate change, but really holding them accountable for their actions. And that we're not taking a stand anymore of letting these fossil fuel companies get away with the effects that they've caused to the climate and also to communities. Because as we know, the 7th anniversary of Sandy just passed on Tuesday, and we've become we've known about climate change on a first name basis because of fossil fuel companies, whether that's Sandy, whether that's Katrina, whether that's Maria. I mean, the list, it just goes on and on and on.
Now, earlier this week, one of the people who testified was Rex Tillerson, who used to be the, chief executive officer of Exxon and then resigned to become the Secretary of State under the Trump administration. What were some of the, I don't know, highlights, raised with, his Tillerson's testimony?
Yeah, so I sat in on the testimony. It was actually yesterday, so it was on Wednesday. And the prosecution did a very good job of kind of laying out the facts and talking about how Exxon had two separate kind of charges that or cost models that they used when trying to account for climate change, one that they used internally and one that they utilized externally. And so that was something that really came out. And then when it came to the defense, Tillerson was really trying to argue that one cost kind of looked at macro level effects or assessments, and one was more project based. But we also found out that Rex Tillerson had an alias while he was CEO of Exxon and used that to talk about these different costs and these different charges that they were using. And so it's just really putting a public face of the fraud and the nefariousness of their lies that Exxon is still, even to this day, and even Mr. Tillerson, who no longer is CEO, is still telling these lies about Exxon as a company and the fake concern that they have for community and for climate change, when we know that they've known about the effects and have done things to make sure that as a public we would blocking that meaningful action to be able to stop or help to counter the effects of climate change.
Now, the New York State Attorney General's lawsuit, is operated under the confines of the law that gives her power under New York State law to bring a lawsuit. Doesn't get at some of perhaps the more central issue that, 30 years ago when Exxon and other companies like Shell were told by their own scientists that, listen, if we continue to burn fossil fuels, we're going to overheat the planet. And they continued to move forward and did that. And, now we're facing the possibility of extinction of life as we know it on the planet. Are there other lawsuits in other places that are trying to get at the even broader misdeeds by Exxon and the other fossil fuel companies?
Yes, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's a lawsuit that is in Massachusetts, and that is also a security fraud lawsuit, but I believe it's also looking at public deception of when it comes to Exxon when talking about climate change. I know that there's been testimony that previous Exxon scientists have given in D.C., and I believe Hawaii is another state that's going to be filing a lawsuit against Exxon when it comes to climate change. And I think although a lot of these lawsuits have been more talking about security fraud and deception of their investors, how they deceived their investors, I think this is a good precedent and stepping stone for what's to come next. So we know that they defrauded their investors. We know that then that means they're capable of defrauding the public. And if they're able to do those things, then it's also likely they've lied about the effects of climate change and when they've known about climate change. And so I think that these lawsuits are a good stepping stone, not only for elected officials, but for their constituents. If these are issues that constituents care about, it can help us to put pressure on those that we elect into office. It can also help us with our organizing efforts around what types of campaigns we want to be doing, what type of messaging we want to be doing, and how we really want to hold these fossil fuel companies accountable in the public eye.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I know one of the things in New York State that 350 has been doing has been pushing the issue, trying to get the state controller to divest from fossil fuels. It seems a little ironic that the state attorney general suing them from fraud on one hand, and yet the Tom DiNapoli has $1 billion, you know, just in Exxon. But in the 90 seconds we got left, you know, what is the next step? What can people do at this point? How do they find out more about 350.org?
Yeah, so you can go to 350.org. We have local groups across the nation. You can plug into your local group. We have a field team of great organizers who are doing work across the U.S. I myself am a field organizer, and those are ways to get involved. We are also involved in a lot of coalition work. There's a lot of like climate change work that's going on across the country, and so there's always ways to plug in, but really making sure that you're plugging into work that is not only focused on climate change work, but we also want to be working from the intersections of this work, whether that's racial justice work, whether that's other socially progressive movements as well, because in order to win this fight, we need to be working from the intersections of that work. But yeah, there's a lot of things that are going on, which will help to define which kind of campaigns we're going to be doing in FY20. So be involved, get involved, get your friends involved, get your family involved, but we need all hands on deck.
So we've been talking with Dominique Thomas, who's one of the organizers for 350.org, or 350. You can check him out on the webpage, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Thank you so much, Mark Dunley. All right, that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Chris Skelly. Our engineer tonight is Sophia K. Helene. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers and interns. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly production meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.